So welcome again, everyone. For those of you who arrived during the meditation or are new to my teaching, my name is Dawn Neal. I am a professional spiritual care counselor, and that is chaplain, and also hold a master's degree in Buddhist studies and spiritual care. A longtime practitioner, of course. And I'm very happy to be back with all of you. So I believe we don't do the mindful movement in this format. That's right, right? So I'll offer a Dharma talk for a little while. We'll do some metta meditation at the end. And we will close at or before 8 o'clock. So can everyone hear me okay? Just sort of give me a signal. It's all good? Okay. Great. So I'm going to talk tonight about mindfulness of context, and that's a particular kind of mindfulness of context, which is a big picture, inviting the big picture into our practice, or our practice into the big picture. And my focus is going to be on engaged Buddhist teachings, starting with the Buddha himself. And how he addressed the issues in his society at the time. So mindfulness of context is one translation of a Pali term, which is sati sampajanya. That's mindfulness and clear comprehension, or mindfulness and full awareness, sort of a compound word. And it has a number of translations. Often one Pali term will have a whole cluster, like a paragraph's worth of English associated with it, right? So Rhys Davids, who wrote the first big Pali dictionary, also defines it as consideration or thoughtfulness. And it's from him we get the translation clear comprehension, actually. Tanissaro Bhikkhu uses the term fully alert. And Analeo Bhikkhu uses to clearly know, Bhikkhu Bodhi, to be fully aware. So you just get a sense, it's a larger scope. So it's not just the breath or one object of attention. It's about the bigger surroundings. Whether it's the surroundings of the body, the surroundings of the room, or the surroundings of our cultural moment that we're in. It can also include big mind, so that sense of spacious awareness. Bhikkhu Analeo writes, to clearly know can be taken to represent the illuminating or awakening aspect of contemplation. Understood in this way, clear knowledge processes the input gathered by mindfulness and thereby leads to the arising of wisdom. So it's a capacity of mind that puts the mindfulness to work, in a sense, helps it develop and mature into panya, wisdom. Like practice, wisdom can be scale invariant. Apply it at multiple levels of our lives, from the minutiae of the tiniest little flit of a thought or a feeling, an emotion, all the way to the scope and scale of societal cycles and environmental eras. In any case, sampajanya takes in whatever there is, whatever has come to be, with a comprehensiveness. That comprehensiveness can be the fullness of this moment. Big mind, big heart, now. This feeling of being inseparable from nature, of simply resting in the simplicity of each moment, each breath, this practice. Mindfulness of walking, eating, all actions. Mindfulness or comprehension of doing this practice that people have been doing for millennia, walking this path that is more ancient than any of the societies that we likely interface with regularly. It's also our current moment. Whatever has come to be, all of it, the beauty, the heartache, the heartbreak, all of it. If your heart breaks in this current cultural moment, I find it useful to let it break, but let it break open. Mine's broken open a number of times, especially in the past year or three, and it can be such a doorway to deep compassion, to a different kind of connection with each other, with the other living beings, with all of us. Sampajanya also includes awareness of purpose. So actions, circumstances, external factors. I'm going to quote here from the Satipatthana Sutta, the refrain. Many of you have heard this many times. It's almost like a liturgy. I'm sorry, my apologies, not the refrain, but in full awareness. The Buddha is saying, again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending their limbs, when wearing robes and carrying the outer robe and bowl, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and in keeping silent. In this way, a practitioner abides, contemplating the body as a body internally and externally, both internally and externally. And they abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So I degendered that a little bit to be more inclusive of other genders besides male. But other than that, it's the original. And of course, the same is true for feelings, heart, mind, and so-called objects of mind or dhammas, which is everything that goes through our heart, mind, from emotions to thoughts to views to opinions, everything. So, in other words, to be clearly aware includes everything. Mindfulness of all of the actions of daily life. I don't think that that list left anything out, at least nothing major. I guess nowadays we could say mindfulness of Zooming, mindfulness of computers, most challenging one for many of us, mindfulness of the smartphone and our interaction with it. This external application of mindfulness is important. In a recent conversation with Andrea Fella, she pointed out the importance of the mindfulness of external bodies. So right now I'm mindful of a bunch of little tiles that are mostly showing your heads and a little bit of your shoulders. But that's my access to mindfulness of external bodies right now. Feelings, inferential moods and mind states are another important form of external mindfulness, mindfulness of context, being clearly aware. It points the way to making other people an important part of our contemplation. Far from dehumanizing other people, this can lead to compassion, to wisdom, and to compassionate action. And lest anyone here think this might be a lesser practice, Analeo records that the Vibhanga, which is an early canonical text of Buddhist psychology, the Abhidhamma, that text makes a very special point of stating that the external application of mindfulness, just as much as the internal one, can lead to full realization. So So it's not just about compassion, relationship, as important as those are. Bhikkhu Bodhi adds, I'm sorry, not Bhikkhu Bodhi, Bhikkhu Anālayo adds that such a balanced cultivation helps to prevent self-centeredness, self-absorption, including other people the whole way. Many of us experienced this directly or indirectly, the realization of the reality of the brutality of racism with the murder of George Floyd. The societal action, compassionate action, that woke up among many people in seeing the suffering in this other human being's body, heart, feelings, mind. To be awake to whatever there is, no matter how difficult, can sow the seeds of change in our hearts, in our relationships, our assumptions, and in our societies. So these are some ways that the practice can be more powerful when held in the frame of a bigger picture. And some teachers, including Sharon Salzberg, speak a lot about this mindfulness of context. It kind of shades into wisdom again. It's like, you know, the classic thing back when everyone was doing Mahasi style practice was you don't focus on the minutiae of lifting, stepping, moving, or breathing if you're trying to cross the street, right? Or if you're walking across someone's driveway. It's mindfulness of context. What's the right speed? What's the right action in this moment? Clearly comprehending our current cultural moment also reveals the results of historical actions and context. I don't need to tell anyone here that we humans have crowded the planet, we've encroached on wild areas, not small conditions for the pandemic now sweeping our country and world. And of course, it highlights the racial, class, and economic disparities. That, plus the brutality I mentioned, are all conditions for clearly comprehending or at least having a glimpse into racism, institutionalized racism, which was built on the building blocks of greed and delusion, harmful delusion, and functions as institutionalized hatred. This is a poem by an author named Ben Okri. And it's an epic poem called Mental Fight. So I'm just going to pull little bits from it rather than read any comprehensive amount. He writes, "What will we choose? Will we allow ourselves to descend into universal chaos and darkness, a world without hope, without wholeness, without moorings, without light? Or might we choose to wake this time a waking up event, a moment of world empowerment, to pledge in private to be more aware, more responsible, more wild, more loving, awake to our unsuspected powers, more amazing? We rise or fall by each choice we make. It all depends on the road we take. And the choice and the road each depend on the light that we have, the light we bend, on the light we use or refuse, on the lives we live by and from which we die. Every moment thus carries the monumental and the ordinary, transcending the political, hinting at the evolutionary. Great sudden leaps of consciousness, spontaneous descents, might all seem revolutionary, but they are merely the seeds long hidden in the earth, bursting forth into shoot. They are merely the moment in what was hidden, growing unseen in history's depths, suddenly brings forth its truest forms, revealing its real nature. The speed and suddenness of an appearance is really only that moment when we become aware of the change in a condition. One condition of most white convert Buddhist lineages, insight meditation lineages, is that they came over with this to this country and to other European, into European countries with an overwhelming emphasis on meditation. Being, without emphasizing so much the context within which this practice has unfolded for millennia. And part of that context is social engagement, offering virtuous actions as ways of cultivating wisdom, compassion, and awakening itself. And Buddhism was socially engaged from the beginning. The Buddha engaged in these kinds of virtuous behaviors based on wisdom, panya, and sampajanya, mindfulness of context. He taught widely, as we know, and the Buddha's teachings clearly had wide-ranging, sustained impact. In terms of social reform, however, the Buddha was most concerned with and had the most obvious impact on his own community. He lived in a time of an inflexible and ubiquitous caste system, as ubiquitous as what the writer Isabel Wilkerson calls the caste system of today, racism. Caste is the bones, she says. Race is the skin. In the Buddha's time, the caste system was reinforced by absolute monarchies. Rather than attempting to reform this caste system in broader society, he abolished it in his own order. And he replaced it with a system based on depth of practice, wisdom, and different forms of skill. The Buddha also repeatedly taught over and over that what makes a noble person, a Brahmin, the caste at the top of the heap in ancient India, was not birth, but a pure heart, pure mind, and virtuous behavior. Actions. He did so in the teaching, did so in a number of teachings, but there was one in particular to two young men, two young Brahmins by birth, who came to him because they were arguing over a question. One of them, Vaseta, was saying, a Brahmin becomes a Brahmin by their actions. And his friend, Varajta, I believe, argued, no, a Brahmin is a Brahmin because of birth. And they came to the Buddha to settle this question. I guess he was the wise man moving through town. And here's what he had to say. I call him not a Brahmin because of his origin and lineage. If impediments still lurk in him, he is just one called Sir, who is unimpeded and clings no more. He I call a Brahmin, who has laid aside the rod against all beings, frail or bold, who does not kill or have them killed. He I call a Brahmin, who is unopposed among opponents, peaceful among those given to violence, who does not cling among those who cling. He is one I call a Brahmin. There are many more of those little verses, but you get the idea. A Brahmin in the Buddha's reframing of what Brahman meant is someone who has dropped forever greed, hatred, and delusion, who exists in conflict with no one else. It's a high bar. Cultivation of this inner ecology to complete awakening, it's quite rare, right, for someone to get to that point. But while rare, long-term practitioners can touch in to places in practice when that can fall away, or when we're not greedy for greed, not addicted to aversion, not confused about delusion. In his verses to these young men, the Buddha reframed, but he didn't point out their inborn privilege to them directly. He did, however, make some very clear statements, points about caste, skin color, and actions. Same teaching, same verse. I will teach you in order as they really are, Vasetha, said the Blessed One, the generic divisions of living beings, because many are the kinds of birth. And he first goes through the grass and trees, saying those lack self-awareness, but they're distinguished by their birth, their species. Next come moths and butterflies, ants and termites, quadrupeds of varied sorts, large and small. No, those whose bellies are their feet, the snakes. No, the water-dwelling fish. No, the birds that range in open skies. For all of these, their birth is their distinctive mark. And then he goes on to say, while in these birth, the differences of birth make their distinctive mark, with humans, no differences of birth make a distinctive mark among them. And then he goes through quite a comprehensive list that I'm going to summarize a little bit. He said, not in the hairs, nor the head, nor ears, nor eyes, nor mouth, nose, lips, or brow. Not in the shoulders, neck, belly, or back. Not in the genitals or forms or choices about mating. Nor in hands or feet, fingers, nails, knees, thighs. Nor in their color, nor in their voice. Here birth makes no distinctive mark of different kinds of birth. In human bodies themselves, nothing distinctive can be found. Distinction among human beings is purely verbal designation. In other words, the Buddha was not ranking human beings by physical distinction. Instead, he differentiated a person by what they do. And at the deepest level, that is the arahat, the fully awakened being who no longer acts ever out of greed, hatred, and delusion. But it can be as simple as, he goes on to say, one who makes their living by agriculture, you should know as a farmer. One who makes a living with varied crafts is a craftsperson. One who makes a living by merchandise is a merchant, and so on and so forth. So he's taking these distinctions completely out of color, gender, sexual orientation, class, or caste, and saying it's what we do. It's how we act that matters. So the Buddha realized that ranking people by physical designation wasn't a real designation. It was verbal, conceptual. That's not to say that this concept can't cause real harm. We've seen that. Colonial aristocrats constructed designations of white and black early in the colonies in response to poor European Americans and Black Americans rising up to try to get a better deal. That was when the term white came into being. And for those of you who haven't already heard it, I refer you to Donald Rothberg's two talks recently here or at Spirit Rock on the history of racism. He goes into a lot more detail than I'm going to touch on tonight. So the Buddha had this consciousness, right? An eradicated caste, anyone, a Brahmin or a Dalit, came into the order and they were a bhikkhu. That was it. Or a bhikkhuni later. He did act as advisor to monarchs ruling these ancient societies. And whether he agreed with them or not, he tried to interject kind of a wisdom perspective into the national leadership of the different countries that he wandered through. There are quite a number of examples of this in the discourses. He also addressed the social order obliquely through analogy, parable, myth, as one might expect of a spiritual teacher in absolute monarchies, who stayed peaceable among warring factions, kings, countries. Some of his teachings are socially applied forms of dependent origination. For those of you who are familiar with dependent arising or dependent origination, the 12-link chain that many of us are taught on retreat or in Dharma talks is one formulation. Dependent arising is actually a general principle, and there are many different formulations in the Pali Canon. And some of them are applied to society. And there's one in particular I'm going to talk about tonight that's a story of societal degeneration and renewal. It's a parable called The Lion's Roar of the Wheel-Turning King. Somebody knows what that is. I see recognition. So I'm going to summarize this. It is quite a long sutta. So basically, in ancient times, society was ruled by, so the parable says, a series of virtuous and wise wheel-turning kings. Their reigns were long, people prospered, society prospered, and lifespans were long and healthy. And it's a parable, right? So the lifespans are in the tens of thousands of years when society is at its peak. There's no poverty, no crime. The first king, Dalmeni, established the security of his realm, it is said, by avoiding evil, doing what is good, attending to what action in the long term leads to welfare and happiness, ensuring the prosperity and safety of his people. He conquered neighboring territories without stick, sword, or fighting, but rather by sheer ethical behavior and guidance and giving to the needy and poor. He was the first of seven generations of these wheel-turning kings, it said, and each has a very similar story. The wheel-turning king is an awakened ruler, and near the end of each one's life, they would pass the crown to their heir, shave their head, don monk's robes, and wander off into the monastic order to practice, and I believe it was usually to full enlightenment. So there were seven generations, as I said, of these enlightened rulers, and the text then speaks of the benighted eighth. Bad luck to be the eighth. After receiving the crown from his father, instead of doing what his father and his father's father and his father's father's father did, and consulting with the wise ministers of the land who'd been holding this knowledge through time, and consulting and abiding by the Dharma, or shall we say, settled law, this king ruled according to his own ideas. perhaps capriciously, impulsively. Well, poverty became rife, and crime soon followed. With the advent of widespread theft, capital punishment began. Then murderous theft began. The use of weapons and incidents of murder increased, and lifespans decreased. Lying began. Lifespans decreased even more. And then, from all of that, divisive speech, sexual misconduct, harsh speech, gossip, covetousness, hatred, and false opinions being promulgated as news or truth. Is any of this sounding familiar? A little bit? Through all of this, the lifespan of the people continued to plummet. Lack of respect for family, contemplatives, wise people, and Brahmins became common. Fine foods, spices, and flavors began to disappear, and coarse grains, like the shelter-in-place rice and beans everybody hoarded, those became common. Eventually, moral conduct disappeared altogether, and evil prevailed. When this happened, it is said the people became fierce with enmity, promiscuous even with blood relatives, and society eventually degraded into a sword interval, it was called, of 7 days in which people regarded each other as beasts and took each other's lives indiscriminately with the swords. In other words, it was societal insanity, complete cultural breakdown. During these darkest of times, some good people stepped away from the fray and, practicing non-harming, hid from the worst of the street war, out in the bushes, the trees, the caves, wherever they could find. At the end of that horrible time, they emerged, it said, rejoicing when they saw each other alive. I'm quoting here, "Good beings, I see that you are alive." And the thought occurred to them, "It is only because we became addicted to evil ways that we suffered all of this loss. So let us now do good." This is, after all, a moral parable, right? Society then, it said, began to regenerate based on wholesome behavior and practices, including some basic precepts: refraining from stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, harsh, divisive, or false speech, refraining from nurturing and acting on hostility and hatred, covetousness, excessive greed, and instead cultivating wisdom, virtuous, or wholesome actions. And as these ancient parables go, they're very symmetrical this way, most of them. Lifespans begin to increase. Wealth begins to increase. Beauty begins to increase. Happiness increases. And with those conditions, those seeds in place, eventually a new enlightened ruler, a wheel-turning king, again arises. So, that's the parable of the lion's roar of the wheel-turning king. From this, we can perhaps infer certain kinds of actions that the Buddha might have considered appropriate to circumstances today. Easier said than done, most of these actions. Fundamentally, it speaks of committing to non-harming. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, do not cause harm or allow others to cause harm. There's a phrase that appears again and again in the discourses that signify this kind of attitude. It's laying aside the rod and sword. And then it says something to the effect of, and it depends on the translation, but trembling for the welfare of all living beings, abiding compassionate, kind, and harmless. And that's often the formulation used before someone very seriously enters into the monastic path of practice. But it's used for lay people as well if they take refuge with the Buddha at times. There's a term also, well, I'll get to the term in a moment, practicing speech that's non-harming, non-divisive, that doesn't rend society apart, was also very important to the Buddha, particularly in his own order. And you can imagine a bunch of unarmed monks who are completely dependent on the kindness of others for their very food and requisites. It's very important that they hang together, right? So he really emphasized this, and there's a term for the kind of speech he said to avoid, which is attacking each other with verbal daggers. Isn't that evocative? And that doesn't mean necessarily fighting face to face. You know, the daggers can happen in other ways too. He's refraining from doing that. To practice restraint. To give the gift of safety. To give the gift of safety does not mean being a doormat. Sometimes not causing harm, not allowing others to harm, can mean being very courageous, even fierce. A strong no uttered once or many times with energy, even anger, as long as that anger does not have as its primary motivation hostility or hatred in it. Despite his own role, the Buddha's role, in advising and attempting to offer wisdom to monarchs, whether in parables like this or in private discussions, the Buddha advises his own community, his own order, to look to your own field, your own ancestral haunt. Sometimes it's translated, gochare. In other words, take care of your own heart, mind, and relationships, your own work, community, neighborhood. And I wonder this right now, can each of us look to and take care of our own field? Can we show up, whatever job or avocation emerges for us, our relationships, our interactions, our block, wherever life and practice intersects with the world, wherever there's a sphere of influence? It doesn't mean changing everything about what one is doing as much as how one is doing it. Most importantly, is it possible to do so in a way that helps to reinforce non-hatred, non-greed, non-delusion in my own heart, in your own heart? Action is one of the most powerful forms of conditioning and cultivation if we reflect on it carefully. Allow our hearts to express imperfectly, but with the intention of practice, with the intention of best possible outcome for self, other, self and other, and the world. And while we're not the historical Buddha, thank goodness our elected officials are also not monarchs, right? We have the power to use our voices as citizens to interject wisdom, compassion, and sanity into the democratic process at every level, including the national level. It may not bear fruit right away, but such seeds must be planted during this dark time in our own society, perhaps to bear wholesome or beautiful fruit sooner or later. Conditions for regeneration of this society. As the Buddha says to the two young Brahmins at the end of that Nisaitha teaching, So that is how the truly wise see action as it really is, as interdependent conditions. The wise are skilled in actions and results. Action makes the world go round. Action makes this generation turn. Living beings are bound by action, like the chariot wheel by the linchpin. Many revered contemporary teachers exemplify this. They continue applying Buddhist teachings, practices, and principles to social engagement. American scholar, monk, and teacher Bhikkhu Bodhi has not only written articles encouraging practitioners to engage, he has walked in many protest marches on environmental issues in particular, but also against global hunger, and helped to found Buddhist Global Relief, which is an organization dedicated to eradicating hunger. There is, in Asia, there are a number, some of whom are living, some of whom are no longer living. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, Maha Gosananda. Tonight, I'm going to mention a few other names that might be a little bit less well-known. One is Sula Sivaraksa. He's a Thai layman, lay Buddhist and activist. And I've got here a quote from Hosen Alan Sanake, another engaged Buddhist teacher in the Zen tradition, who's writing about Sulak, quoting him, saying, regarding the second noble truth, we try to understand the external and psychological roots of the conflict. When we project our emotions onto an object, animate or inanimate, we experience the other as having traits which in fact dwell first in our own unconscious mind. To discover the roots of any conflict, we must also examine its psychological dimensions. As Sulak suggests, Sanake says, inner work goes hand in hand with social action. Together, they must be our life and practice. The root of the word Buddha, Bu, means to be awake. When we are awakened to simplicity and humility and aware of the suffering engendered by greed, hatred, and ignorance, our consciousness is restructured. We become mindful about ourselves and others and naturally try to restructure society. Donald Rothberg mentioned to me recently that he had a conversation with Sulak Sivaraksa, in which Sulak told Donald that he was concerned about how much Western convert Buddhism focused so centrally on meditation, saying it could create, and this is the quote, strong tendencies for Western Buddhism being in large part only a way for middle-class people to relax and find some peace without the social and societal engagement much Asian Buddhism has had. There is nothing wrong with relaxing and finding some peace. And there's a broader scope for many of these teachers. Ariaratne is a Sri Lankan lay Buddhist teacher who founded a movement called Sarvodaya. And Sarvodaya, and this is mostly from Wikipedia, though I actually have read books by them. It's hard to get to an academic library right now. Sarvodaya focuses on political empowerment at the village level in Thailand. If you've ever been to Thailand, you know that villages are kind of a fabric of the country that's quite different than you see in Bangkok or the bigger cities. So they focus on that empowerment and on Buddhist awakening. The call of Sarvodaya is to be a non-violent spiritual revolution to replace structural violence as the basis of the social order. This spiritual revolution features the Buddhist value of non-violence, and it also promotes a no poverty, no affluence society. And in this process, Aryabhatta framed the Four Noble Truths in a very much a relational, social, societal kind of way. And this is, I believe, from their website, if I'm recalling correctly. So the first noble truth, suffering exists, dukkha, is glossed, should recognize problems such as poverty, disease, oppression, and disunity in our environment. This should be addressed by those who have the ability to help with the suffering on both an individual level as well as the community as a whole. The second noble truth, the arising or cause of suffering. The causes are said by Sarvodaya to lie in factors such as selfishness, competition, greed, and hatred. Again, institutionalized, not just in a person's heart. Third noble truth, the suffering of the poor can cease through our own efforts and the help of others, helping villagers, the disenfranchised, rebuild their lives and form a strong community bond based on helping one another. And the fourth noble truth, that each part of the Eightfold Path can be applied to the restoration of the people. And this can be something as practical as working bathrooms, running water, filtered running water, and roads, or as inspiring as basic and higher education and fusion of life purpose. The point is to attend to needs to help each person in the community relieve some of their suffering as an expression of Buddhist practice. Again, to call back what I said earlier about Bhikkhu Anālayo, internal and external practice, both are capable of taking a practitioner to awakening. Joanna Macy, a beloved teacher here in the Bay Area and quite a scholar in her own right, is quoted in a book called The Path of Compassion. She talks about having gone to Sri Lanka, and she says, some fellow scholars of Western Buddhism who I had consulted considered Sarvodaya's reinterpretation of doctrine, its version of the Four Noble Truths, to be a newfangled adulteration of Buddhism, lacking in doctrinal respectability. When I asked very learned Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka what they thought of this recasting of the Four Noble Truths, I did so with the expectation that they too would see it as a corruption of the purity of the Buddha's teachings. Instead, almost invariably, they seemed surprised that a Buddhist would even ask such a question. Gave me an answer that was like a slight rap on the knuckles. And here she's quoting, but it's the same teaching, don't you see? Whether you put it on the psycho-spiritual plane or socioeconomic plane, there is suffering and there is the cessation of suffering. Just as these teachers, just as the Buddha himself encouraged his community, perhaps each of us can act in our communities, our fields, in small ways. I don't think any of us here are founders of a major religious world religious order. But we can be part of an emergent goodness, contributing towards goodness. This is from the Terigata, interpreted from the Pali by scholar practitioner Maddie Weingast. These are the words of an enlightened elder Buddhist nun named Uttama. The entire path, all you will ever need to walk it, you will find inside. So the Buddha taught me. Once I took a closer look, all the running around started to seem a little silly. Things changed so quickly. By the time I got anywhere, I'd be someone else. You are your mother. You are your daughter. One moment gives birth to the next. What we do is what we become. So in conclusion, while this talk, in a sense, is all about action, what we do is what we become, it is so important that that action come as a natural response of the heart. Not an obligation, not all that running around. To act by forcing ourselves into action is a kind of violence against one's own heart. And there's enough violence in this troubled age. Just as beings, humans, are known by the diversity of our actions rather than our birth, so too we can express care for each other in many diversities of ways. Ways that feed and nourish a sense of efficacy, hope, joy, and even ongoing awakening. So consider the possibility of finding joy through practicing with, acting on our larger context. In the history of this practice and on the movements of your own heart. Expression and action in society does not have to be separate from your practice. I've found it to be one of the strongest supports and highest expressions of it, rather than a distraction. So thank you for your kind attention. Welcome questions, comments, complaints, or notions. Anyone has anything to say?
Yes, the story of the Buddha talking to the two Brahmins, what sutta is that from?
It is Majjhima Nikaya 98, and it's called the Vasetha Sutta. Most of it is actually in verse, but unfortunately it doesn't rhyme in the English the way it does in the Pali, right? Yes?
While you're citing suttas, where do you find the parable of the seven kings?
So the lion's roar of the wheel-turning king is in the Digha Nikaya, or the long discourses. If you don't have the book, I believe there is an alternate translation on accesstoinsight.org. I'm not 100% sure about that. But I didn't bring the book because I actually summarized it. It's quite long, but it is interesting reading. It's Digha Nikaya 26.
I have a question. One of the last things you said was, and I'll probably get it wrong, but it had to do with making sure that it was more like a spontaneous or a natural movement of the heart, that action shouldn't be duty. But is there a place for, I mean, in a lot of instances, it might be a long time before I can purify the heart to really make sure it all comes from there. Is there an instance, or is there a practice of transforming the heart through engaged Buddhism, or through, you know, I mean, the idea of generosity, it seems to me that that's it in some way. So can you speak to that a little bit?
I'm happy to. I think you just answered your own question, Corey. So natural doesn't mean it has to be spontaneous. I can naturally make a decision that I'm going to dedicate my life to, and in fact, I have done this, the practice of relational Moranasati, that is caring for the dying. Now, I don't naturally every single day I go in to do that work necessarily feel like doing on that day, but I've made this larger aditana, this vow, this intention, and I have seen the way that that changes my heart and mind to be the kind of person and practitioner I want to become. So it doesn't feel like a duty, but it does feel like a practice. I guess what I'm really trying to suggest is that each of us find things that fit our own vision of our own practice, not that it has to feel good in any moment. If we wait until we are free of greed, hatred, and delusion to act, we'll never act. Thank you very much for the question. Any other questions or comments or ideas about this talk? I want to acknowledge this is a bit of an unusual talk for me, and maybe unusual among the talks you hear. So, any qualms? Any of you have? Yeah, Fred, please.
I found this really interesting. Because, you know, I think, like a lot of my Dharma friends, I got into, I practice for myself. I practice for my own might and for my own. And if there's a benefit to others, that's fine. And so this is kind of a, I know this is sort of a Western convert Buddhist sort of take, but I noticed that in a lot of my friends, Dharma friends. So I appreciate this this other offering. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred. Vida.
Yeah, Don, I just want to thank you. Appreciate the timeliness, to the lives we're living right now. And to whatever we're doing out there to try to avoid the eighth realm. But thank you. It was very timely. It was very meaningful. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Vida. And Mary, yes?
I, too, really appreciate it. I am someone who's fairly politically active and always hunger for better and newer ways, you know, to be able to be politically active or to be socially active. And to be able to do it in a Buddhist context, you know, rather than in a, you know, in a more secular context. That's something I'm always looking for.
Have you found any contexts that have supported you in that way in the wider Dharma?
Well, not particularly lately. You know, with given the COVID-19, no, because we're so, you know, kind of restricted in a sense at this point. I mean, the activity that I and my husband do is real active in terms of letter writing, encouraging people to vote. You know, in this context, it's about all you can do if you're over 65. Can't really get out and do too much other than that. I mean, we're somebody who are always out involved in protests, but you can't do too much protesting right now safely.
No, it's a challenge. And there's so much that can be done beyond protests, as I'm sure you know, in terms of organizing, but that's also a challenge to work in. Barbara, I think I saw your hand up.
I just wanted to say I appreciated the look at external practice as a way to break through self-centeredness, because I think the two really do work together. Because internal practice can help you from self-righteousness. And so if in some ways you really do need the two if you're ever going to awaken, no matter who you're doing it for. So I appreciated that.
Thank you, Barbara. Yeah, I think one of the things that really became a clue for me is I've sat a lot of retreat time, like a lot in the years. And there are certain ways of showing up that you can't see by yourself. You got to have people holding a mirror up to the back of your head or the side of your head to be able to see the impact. And collective practice or relational practice, internal and external or external practice, can be a really helpful counterbalance. And in that sense, it feels like it's smoothing off a different set of rough edges than being on the cushion does. So thank you for the comment. It's helpful. And to say that also, I think there is a deep truth to it is not wasted time to spend a lot of time on the internal cultivation. It's finding the right balance for this body and mind, whichever this body and mind we're talking about, because both are incredibly helpful. And while external practice, as Anali quoted the Abhidhamma, can take one to enlightenment, it didn't say that that's the only thing you do. Got to do both. So any other thoughts before we move to the metta portion of the evening?